Please have your Bibles open to Matthew chapter 17 at this time. We're going to be looking at the account in Matthew of the transfigurations. It's typically what we apply to the story where Jesus is seen to be transformed before his disciples' eyes. John, James, and Peter being the disciples there with him on the mountaintop. Now we know that this experience left quite an impression on them. Peter and John both mention the transfiguration in their epistles later on in life. And we typically see it as a great moment of victory for their faith, quite an experience for them to see the glorified Jesus right before their eyes. And surely this was the pinnacle for them, not just literally being on a mountaintop, but also spiritually during the ministry of Jesus. It was not long after this that the disciples faced quite a trial of their faith as Jesus went to Jerusalem and was eventually destroyed by those in power at the time. But it wasn't all rosy for the disciples leading up to the transfiguration. In fact, if you read in the preceding chapters in the book of Matthew, they've had quite a wild ride emotionally and in their faith. Jesus has been put to the test by the Pharisees. He has been harangued and hounded by them, questioned by them. He's had to explain to them a great many things, both the Pharisees, his enemies, and his disciples as well. So he takes them to a place in Matthew 16 called Caesarea Philippi. He takes them to a place near Panea in the first century, which was considered to be the opening to the gates of Hades. There in Caesarea Philippi at the bottom of a cliff, there was a large mouth at the bottom of the cliff from which a spring rose forth. And the pagans believed that to be the opening to Hades. There were alcoves cut into the cliffside where there would be votive offerings and candles and statues in place. And it is at that place where Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" They say, "Well, some people think that you're Elijah or one of the prophets or you're John the Baptist." And they certainly didn't believe that he was literally the reincarnated Elisha or Jeremiah or John the Baptist, but that he came in the form of them. And he says, "Well, that's what other people think. What do you think? Who do you say that I am?" Peter said, "Well, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God." So Peter looks up at the cliff in front of him and the mouth to the gates of Hades, as the pagans believed, and all of the little idols cut into the alcoves of the cliff face. James is looking around. John sees all of it. And Peter says, "Upon this rock I'll build my church." Not the physical rock that you're looking at. And even the gates of Hades can't dare it down. This gate of Hades that the pagans believe is right here in front of us, that can't tear it down. Pagan powers won't tear it down. Physical obstacles won't tear it down. The evil that surrounds us won't tear it down. And while that seems like a high point, again, Jesus very quickly changes gears and begins telling his disciples from that point forward, "I'm actually going to go back to Jerusalem, and I will be destroyed physically, and I'll be raised up." Peter says, "Surely not. That's impossible. I wouldn't ever let that happen to you. That's just silly." "Get behind me, Satan," Jesus responds. "Get behind me." And I believe it's in the same area where Jesus takes them to a very high mountain, beginning in Matthew chapter 17, verse 1. And he is going to show them just what kind of power he has, just who he is, glorified in a physical form that I would say even pales in comparison to what he will see, what we will see of him in the afterlife. 6 days later, I like this idea here in Matthew chapter 17, verse 1. 6 days later. Isn't it amazing how I can't get four words into a verse without saying something? But isn't it amazing how Jesus takes them on this wild ride emotionally of confronting the Pharisees and then And then getting the confession and saying, and my church is going to be this great thing built upon a rock. It is going to be stable, more stable than anything else that you can possibly imagine. And how great is that? Oh, but then we're going to go down to the bottom, to the pit of despair, and I'm going to be destroyed. And if you doubt that, then get behind me, Satan. He gave them 6 days to stew about that. 6 days to ponder that, to think about that, to scratch their heads and go, okay, well, we said he was the Messiah, and he patted us on the back for it. And then he said he was going to get killed by the chief priests, and he got mad at us when we told him that couldn't possibly happen to the Messiah. I'm not sure what to think anymore. And they had 6 days to think about that. You know, sometimes God lets us go through that. He allows us time to process things. He allows us time to wrestle with things, and yes, to maybe get a little bit frustrated. He gives us the time that we need, sometimes the time we don't even realize that we need, to stew about things. We've got to process things in our time, don't we? 6 days, though, think about that. 6 days before this subject seems to be readdressed. 6 days to face their questions and their doubts. 6 days to struggle and grapple with what really seems like contradictory information. 6 days. So he took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and brought them up to a high mountain by themselves. Why these disciples? What is it about Peter, James, and John that he would pick those three out of the 12 and take them with him? Now, some speculate it's just a matter of maturity, that Jesus recognized Peter, James, and John as being more mature than the others. Peter, James, and John certainly have been with Jesus for other events in his life where he singled them out, where he seemed to talk to them, if not exclusively, then certainly in a more focused manner on certain subjects. It was these disciples who were with Jesus in certain scenarios. For example, when he raised Jairus' daughter in Mark 5:37, or in Luke's account in chapter 8, verse 51. It was these three men together with Andrew, who was Peter's brother, who had been the earliest followers of Jesus. They were disciples of John the Baptist, but learned about Jesus very quickly and began following him after that. It was these three disciples who were invited to join Jesus while he was praying in the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew 26, verse 37. So for whatever reason, Jesus saw these three disciples as the ones who needed to come to the mountaintop with them. Now, one thing to keep in mind is, for an omniscient God, having the knowledge of omniscience at his disposal, he knows what's going on at the bottom of the mountain. And when the transfiguration is done, he returns to the other disciples, and it presents an opportunity to him at the bottom of the mountain to show God's power. So it could just be that he takes these three disciples, knowing that the other nine, well, they're going to make a mess of things while he's gone, and it gives him an opportunity to show the power of God in a miracle. But for whatever reason, these three disciples go with Jesus to the top of a very high mountain. Now, I notice it's not described which mountain it is. It's never said which mountain it is. Now, we can speculate about which mountain it is, but I like that the Bible doesn't include that information. And part of the reason why the Bible wouldn't include that information, perhaps, just me speculating, is that we're not supposed to care. That it doesn't matter. You remember what Jesus said to the woman at the well in the book of John? He meets a Samaritan woman at the well, and she talks to him about religion, and you Jews believe this, and you worship down in Jerusalem, and we believe this, and we worship on that mountain over there. And Jesus stops her and says, listen, you worship on that mountain, and we worship on that mountain. I tell you a truth, that the true worshipers will come, and they will not worship on any mountain or whatever, specifically because it's special. They'll worship anywhere. Because they'll worship in spirit and in truth, and there's nothing special about one mountain or another mountain. And you know how people are, that if we knew exactly which mountain it was where the transfiguration would take place, you know that there would be a tourist trap on the top of it. And people would travel from all over the world to go see the mountain of transfiguration. And they would miss the whole point of it. The whole point's not the mountain. The point is the one on the mountain being glorified. Now again, that's just me speculating about why we're not told what the mountain is, but it seems to make sense. Mountains are an amazing thing. I've climbed several mountains in my life. I've been to the top of Humphreys Peak here in Arizona, the tallest mountain in this state. I've been to 3 out of 4 of the highest mountains in the state of Oregon. Love hiking. Lance and I could talk about hiking all day long, probably. Mountains are just, there's something about them that draws you in. They're beautiful. There's something to look at. They're a unique physical challenge. And there's great things that happen on mountains as well. If you recall from the Bible, there were great events that happened on mountains. For example, it was on top of a mountain that Moses received the law from God, Mount Sinai. It was on a mountain that Elijah received revelation. The mountaintop served as the showdown between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, or the priests of Baal in 1 Kings 18. Abraham showed his willingness to offer his son on a mountain. It was from a mountain that Jesus was crucified. It was on a mountain where Jesus was tested by Satan. One thing to keep in mind here with mountains in the Bible is if something takes place on a mountain, it's usually a pretty big event. If you're reading through the Bible and it says, and so they went to a mountain, buckle up because something interesting is about to happen. Not that the rest of the Bible isn't interesting, but boy, mountaintops. Those are pivotal moments in the Bible when things happen on mountains. Now, he was transfigured before them, Matthew 17, verse 2 says. Transfigured. He was changed physically. His appearance was altered. His face shone like the sun, and his garments became as white as light. Mark's account in Mark 9, verse 3 says that his garments became radiant and exceedingly white, as no launderer on earth can whiten them. Now, I appreciate Matthew and Mark and Luke and their explanation of this. I appreciate that. That they do the best that they can with what human language has to offer. But I'll say this, and this isn't a knock on the Bible, and it's not a knock on the Bible's writers, by the way, and this is not a knock on the Holy Spirit who inspired them. But human language simply fails us. Human language fails us. And I think there's something really special about the way that the Bible writers almost fumble around with the language to try and describe what it looked like. They're almost fumbling around trying to figure out, well, how do we describe this? How do we describe what it looks like when the glory of God's power is channeled into one physical location on planet Earth? How do we describe what it looks like when a physical human being, Jesus of Nazareth, is shown to be the glorious Son of God? How do we explain that? Because God is faceless, and God is not limited to one location. God is all places at once. He's not a physical being. He's not bound by those things, time and space. How do we describe it? And so they do the very best that human language can do. You know that white garment of yours? Your favorite white shirt? And look at this. Look at how disgusting this looks. You know, that's the thing about white shirts. And you know, I have a little bit of that, what do they call it, obsessive compulsive. I don't call it a disorder because we went to the moon because of obsessive compulsive people, okay? When you're calculating gimbals and numbers and trajectories and everything, that's not the time where you want people like just kind of guesstimating, right? You want someone with OCD doing that sort of thing. But the thing about it is, I love a white dress shirt because nothing says tidy like a white dress shirt. But also, nothing says vanity of vanities like a white dress shirt and having 3 children. That's why I keep my jacket on all the time, so you don't see, well, that's the stain that Sterling caused, and that's the one that Heidi did, and that's the handprint from Bennett. Right? White shirts, it's almost like a vain effort to try and keep a white shirt white. And so I totally agree with the assessment that whatever Jesus looked like was whiter than any white garment that a launderer could make. It is whiter than the cleanest white shirt on planet Earth. Whiter than that? Yeah, whiter than that. His face shining, not just shining, but radiant and exceedingly bright. Exceedingly bright. Rebecca forgot her sunglasses on her last leg of the Ragnar relay yesterday. And I feel for her also, because she got back into the car when all was said and done, just put a shirt over her face and just had to sit there in the dark for a while because her eyes were bothering her so bad. Now that's the sun, a physical thing in the physical universe shining physical light upon us. And Jesus was more exceedingly radiant and bright than that. That's glory right there, my friends. That is glory. Now the transfiguration was a pivotal moment for these disciples. Peter notes in 2 Peter chapter 1, we were eyewitnesses of His majesty. In John 1 verse 14, we have beheld His glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. And they could say those things literally. We saw this, the glory of God channeled into one physical location. And it changed them for the rest of their lives. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3. I love the way that the writer of Hebrews describes it here. In such beautiful and succinct language, he says, in these last days, beginning in verse 2, God has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom He also made the world. And He, Jesus, the Son of God, He is the radiance, the brightness of His glory and the exact representation of His nature. The book of Revelation notes in the last couple chapters that in heaven, in God's kingdom, there is no need of the sun because we'll have Jesus there. No need of the sun. There'll be no darkness and no night because Jesus is there. The transfiguration was a glimpse into the true appearance and true nature of the Son. It was a transcendent visage that pointed to His divine nature and also to what we will become. You know, we're in awe of the glory of Christ in the transfiguration, but the transfiguration is also a sampling of what will be in the resurrection. We don't always think about that, do we? In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 49, it notes that as Jesus was glorified, that His heavenly body or that heavenly existence is so much more glorious than what He was in the flesh. It also notes that we'll become like that. That we're going to trade in our physical glory for heavenly glory one day. And in 1 John 3 and verse 2, that we do not know yet, as yet, what we'll be like. But whatever we're going to be like in the resurrection, it's going to be like Jesus. And we'll get to see Him just as He is. Not with physical eyes that have to turn away because of the brightness, but with spiritual eyes that are drawn in because of the similarity. Verse 3. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with them. And yeah, that's the title of the slide. Moses and Elijah? Really? Wow. Now, great practical application here. That the writers of the Bible, Peter, James, and John, as they relayed the information to the writers of the gospel accounts, they could recognize it was Moses and Elijah. I don't know how. Surely they didn't know what Moses and Elijah looked like, but there was something about them, something of their character, the way they talked, the way that they interacted with Jesus. There was something about them that Peter, James, and John knew. That's Moses, and that's Elijah. And here they are with our dear friend, Jesus. Moses and Elijah. One can only speculate about why Moses and Elijah, of all the great saints from ages past, were chosen to meet Jesus. Moses and Elijah, why not Abraham and Elijah? Why not Moses and Jeremiah? Why not Isaiah and David? Why Moses and Elijah? And again, I can only speculate, but here are a few theories that I have about why Moses and Elijah joined Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. First of all three of them talked with God on a mountain. So that's an important point. In Exodus chapter 19, Moses speaks to God on Mount Sinai. And in 1 Kings 19, Elijah talks to God on the mountain as well. They were both glorified in some way. Exodus 34. And 2 Kings chapter 2, beginning in verse 11. They shared similarly unnatural experiences as they departed earth. That's right, Siri. Moses immediately died a painless death, oddly enough, on a mountain in Deuteronomy chapter 34, and Elijah was exempted from death altogether as he triumphantly left planet Earth on a fiery chariot. Jesus was resurrected also in Acts chapter 2 and verse 32. So there are a number of similarities between them. But there's a great lesson here that we can learn. The disciples needed to be reminded that physical death is not the end of our existence. They needed to be reminded that the resurrection was going to be a real, tangible event. And that when we die, when we leave this physical existence, that there is something of us, and I would even say the more substantial part of us, the real you, still exists. The physical body falls away. It decays in the ground. It's cremated, and it's done away with as ash. That's it. And that's your physical body. And that's the end of all of us. No matter how good the embalming job is, no matter how expensive the casket, you cannot get away from the fact that your physical body someday is going to be practically nothing. Nothing but a little bit of physical material left behind. But the real you, the Moses and Elijah you, that still exists. The soul, the spirit, the essence. And that's the greater part of who you'll be. Yeah, think about this. You get to live in this physical body at best for 100 years, right? I mean, that's at best, you're looking at 100 years in your physical body. Most of us aren't going to get that far. At best, you get 100 years in this physical body. If you live those 100 years for God, if you devote yourself to God, if you are saved in the grace of Jesus Christ, you will be resurrected in a spiritual body. It doesn't have fingers and toes and skin and hair. You will be resurrected in a spiritual body that will be your spiritual body for the rest of eternity. Now, I'm being silly when I say this. Thousands upon thousands and millions upon millions of years. We know that there aren't millions of years in eternity. Time won't exist there. Time is a physical thing. It's a construct of this universe. But think about that. You'll get to be a physical you with fingerprints and eye color and a social security number for at best 100 years. And whatever you're going to be in the resurrection will be you for the rest of eternity. So ask yourself, what's the real you? Right? What's the real you? What's the bigger version of you? The more substantial version of you? Now, all of this corresponds perfectly with the end of chapter 16, doesn't it? That he has just shocked his disciples. He has shocked them by saying, I'm going to die. I mean, you know I'm the Messiah. You've acknowledged that. You've said, I'm the Christ, the Son of the living God. And you've accepted that now. And that's a wonderful thing. But guess what? I'm going to die. They will kill me, and it will be gruesome. And maybe they missed the part. They got so preoccupied with the dying part. Peter, James, and John maybe didn't hear the next part of, and I'll be raised up after 3 days. They didn't catch that part of it, because they were so disturbed by the dying part. Now, after such a shocking experience 6 days earlier in Caesarea Philippi, I think it would have come as a very great comfort to look up and see two people who have been dead for hundreds of years and realize they're not really dead. There's Moses, and there's Elijah, and they're still real. And they're still real. Death is not annihilation. Death is not the end. Now, I don't always put my foot in my mouth. Sometimes I like to put both of them in. Notice verse 4, if you will. And you'll understand the meme in a moment. Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. And that's when he should have stopped, right? It's good for us to be here, period. I'm going to sit back and watch now. But you know how Peter is. Mr. Gung-ho. Peter's full of ideas. He's the sort of guy, I can understand Peter. You know, Peter and I would get each other. You know, he's the guy, he'll throw a dozen ideas out, and if one of them just happens to stick to the wall, then it's been a good day. It's been a good day. And our elders know what that's like. They know what it's like to sit in a meeting where Ryan shows up with a list of 12 things and says, "Why don't this be a cool idea? And we could try this, we could try that thing, and we could always do this thing." And, you know, if they only shoot down 11 of those things, I go home pretty happy about that. You know, Peter's like, "I'm overwhelmed by this. This is an exciting thing we're experiencing. This is a moment of glory and excitement and exaltation. I got to do something. I got to do something right now." He's so excited. And I give him credit for being excited. And I'm not judging him because, I don't know, maybe you and I would have been the same way. Stick our foot right in our mouth. "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll make 3 tabernacles here. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." You know, there's something quite absurd about this suggestion, though. Having seen the glory shining, outshining the sun, radiance that can hardly be described by human language, Peter's looking around going, "We got to do something about this, right?" Well, let's talk about this for a moment. Obviously, Peter is impressed with the scene, and I think we need to give him credit for that. That, you know, we can poke fun a little bit at Peter, and I suppose in the afterlife, we can all go up to Peter and say, "Remember that one time you thought you could make a tent that would be the equal of your experience on the Mount of Transfiguration? Remember that one time? What exactly was that tent going to look like, Peter? And you know, what'd you have in mind? You know, you kept a skein of yarn or something in your bag, a roll of canvas, what, you know? What was that tent going to look like, Peter? Nice tent?" We'll all give him a hard time, and I'm sure he'll have a sense of humor about it. But let's give him credit for the excitement and the enthusiasm. I think that's a good thing to say. But some things are just meant to be observed, not improved upon. For as excited as Peter was, that was a moment for him not to improve upon it or add to it or contribute to it. That was a moment for him to simply take it in. You can't make the Grand Canyon any more grand than it is. There's nothing you can add to it. There's nothing you can add to it. It's already as grand of a canyon as you're going to find. There's just some things. The Star Wars trilogy, the original trilogy, should not have been added to ever. Standalone, cinematic perfection, everything else is just like adding on to a small, ugly house, okay? It's just, you know, there's just nothing. Some things you just can't improve upon. You just have to leave them alone and observe and let them be. So a couple of practical applications here for the one who likes to stick his foot in his mouth, which is me. Be sure to think about your ideas before voicing them. Try to think through. What are the implications? What are you actually saying? And what will this actually lead to? What is the outcome of what you're suggesting right now? Because sometimes we throw things out there without realizing what will happen in 24 hours. That if we actually implement this plan, how is this actually going to affect people? What is this going to do to people 24 hours from now? Peter was talking when he should have been listening and learning. There is a time to talk. There is a time to contribute. There is a time to offer suggestions. And there's a time to simply shut your mouth and listen. And when you have Moses and Elijah and Jesus, that's the time to just listen. Also, like I said, what kind of a tabernacle was Peter going to slap together? I mean, it's not like he had anything with him. Did he honestly have a roll of canvas tucked away in his bag or his satchel that day? Did he honestly think that there were 3 tabernacles that he could slap together on this day that would really be the equal of the occasion? Ideas that just sound really good when you throw them out there end up proving very hard to bring together when you really don't have any resources at your disposal. Right? Neat idea, Peter, but you get an F- there on the implementation. What tabernacle could Peter have possibly put together? Maybe it sounded good on paper, but it wouldn't have been realistic. It wouldn't have been helpful at the time. So as we near the end of our text, while he was still speaking in verse 5, and I do love that, by the way, that while he was still speaking, "Peter, that's enough. That's enough. We don't need the extra ideas right now. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice out of the cloud was saying, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Maybe what bothered God at this point is the presumption that Moses and Elijah even deserved tabernacles next to Jesus. Peter said only a chapter ago, 6 days earlier, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." But there was still something in him of how he was raised, of his expectations perhaps. The lofty ideas that he had about people like Moses and Elijah. Yes, he accepted that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God. But was he willing to accept that the Christ was greater than even Moses and Elijah? Greater than the lawgiver, Moses? Greater than the greatest prophet of all, Elijah? He accepted Jesus as the Christ, but had he accepted Christ as supreme yet? And that's a struggle that a lot of his contemporaries had to face as well. It was a struggle that they had to face when Gentiles came to the faith. And what are we supposed to do about Gentiles? Uncircumcised, Gentiles who didn't keep the Sabbath, Gentiles who ate pork, Gentiles who didn't follow our customs and our laws, Gentiles who didn't even understand Moses, and they don't get it, and they're not children of Abraham like we are. But if you believe that Christ is supreme and superior and exalted above even Moses and Elijah, then you see where that leads you. You have to accept Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God, and the Christ is superior to everything else. He does not stand level with anybody or anything or any idea. He's greater than all of it. Now, I don't think that God was angry with Peter, but this needed to be nipped in the bud right now. Even as Peter was throwing out his idea about tabernacles, God interrupts him and says, "Listen! This is my Son. You could have Moses, or you could have Elijah. And I'm telling you right now, you want my Son. Listen to him. And he's the way of life." And when the disciples heard this, they were very much afraid. Maybe as afraid as John was in Revelation 1 when he saw Jesus glorified again and all he could do was bow down before it. And what was Jesus' response in Revelation 1? As glorious as Jesus is described there, what was his response to John? "Don't be scared. You know who I am." The same man that they walked with and talked with, the same man who taught them, who treated people so tenderly, who was so kind to children, who was so kind to the outcasts of society, the same man with a physical hand who would reach out and touch people, people with illnesses and diseases like leprosy, who had not felt the touch of another human being since their diagnosis. The same man who I'm sure had a lovely sense of humor, who spoke so kindly to some, but could be so hard on others when he needed to be. The same man that they beheld with their eyes and touched with their hands. That is the same one who is the glorified Son of God. What Jesus is as the Christ sitting at the right hand of the Father, that's who he was extending to them during his ministry. They were very much afraid of what they saw. But as soon as they opened their eyes with so much fear and trepidation, as soon as they opened their eyes, what did they see before them? But Jesus returned to normal. Jesus returned to normal and saying, "Let's go get back to work. Let's go back to the bottom of the mountain. The other nine are waiting for us. And a world of lost souls are beyond them. Let's go." Jesus is our great friend. And he is our Savior. And we're not supposed to be afraid of him. if we love Him, if we obey Him, if we put Him first, and if we come under the umbrella of His wonderful, matchless grace. So if you're not a Christian here this morning, please become one. Listen to the call of the gospel in Mark 16, verse 16, which says, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." So if you have any spiritual need at all, then please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.